Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode number 75, recorded June 24th, 2010, The Red Dot of Death. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. It's time for Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, your weekly dose where we dive into things in the nitty-gritty that makes the technology that we all enjoy and love either work or not work so great, depending on what kind of day you're having. I'm Ryan Shrout, joined once again by the lovely and talented Patrick Norton.
I'm lovely today. Why, thank you. See, it's the iPhone 4. It makes you prettier, people.
Well worth whatever price you had to pay for it. So yeah, we are going to talk about the iPhone 4 a little bit. We're talking about a couple of problems it has. We're going to talk about not a whole lot of actual component-based PC hardware today, but we'll have a whole lot of that next week, I can assure you, based on some of the launches that I know are coming up. But that doesn't mean we don't have a lot of tech to talk about. So let's dive right in here. The first thing I kind of wanted to touch on is the new Xbox 360S. Which is the official slim. Name most people are calling. Yeah, most people call it the Slim. It's not really that much smaller than the previous generation Xbox. I have one right here. And it's
the black.
Smaller.
It makes everything slimmer.
it's got, you know, it still kind of comes in the middle. So here, let's we can do this. If you're watching the video version, you can see them side by side. I mean, there's a difference. There's more height difference than a slim difference, I would say, but it's a nice looking device if you care about how attractive your gaming consoles are, really. I'm not sure a ton of people are like that, but it has pretty much the same goods that the other consoles have had. You know, you've got your power button, you've got your eject button, but they're touch-based instead of actual mechanical buttons, and they make kind of annoying beepy sounds.
I'm a little disappointed with the incredibly shiny black surface that picks up fingerprints, not unlike an iPad or an iPhone.
Yeah.
And so the red ring of death is gone, but there is another indicator for a system fail.
Yeah, it's like it's a red dot now. So they took out the rings, and now there's like a dot in the middle. So it's green when it's on, and I guess I'm hearing it's red when it's dead.
The red
so
dots now of death.
Yeah, exactly. Hard drive is actually still pretty easily accessible. It's in a different cage. It's still not just a bare hard drive or anything. It's in its own little kind of enclosure, but it's still. And you can see maybe. It does have, it's just a standard 2.5-inch SATA hard drive in there. And so if you break
gigabytes.
Open this case, 250 gig is the shipping model.
Very not compatible with the previous generation of Xbox 360 drives, which
right.
is a shame.
Technically, you could break them open and, you know, move the hard drive from one casing to the other, I think. Mm-hmm. That would work because they're both 2.5-inch hard drives. It's just a matter of what kind of proprietary case Microsoft wanted to put it in that time. So that's always nice. Power connection is different as well. So you won't be able to reuse cables and that kind of stuff.
Is that a shaver cord or a proprietary connection?
I'm not sure. I think it's probably proprietary based on that. Kind of looks the inverse of like the Sony power cable connections for power bricks and stuff.
But so basically, don't lose your power cord.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. Again, you know, talking about the fingerprint issue, I mean, it's a console. It's not a handheld device or anything like that. So I don't think it's going to be a big deal for fingerprints. For demonstrations like this, it kind of is.
I'm just sort of anti-black shiny surfaces on anything that goes into my home at this point.
We'll show dust, that kind of stuff, I'm sure. You got your Kinect connection right here. So that's the one with the orange line over it. Then you've got more USB ports, Ethernet, standard AV, HDMI, optical audio, that kind of stuff. Now the real goods, and you'll see here you've got your exhaust fan here. So the old system kind of exhausted from the top or the bottom. This one has a larger single fan as opposed to smaller dual fans that were actually emitting air from the back of the console. So that's part of the reason why it is significantly noticeably quieter than the old one as well. Now we had we tore it apart on PC Perspective. We actually live streamed us breaking it and ripping it apart and breaking some clips that we shouldn't have broken and that kind of stuff. So that was fun and interesting.
That's actually kind of an interesting change on it. I did not realize you were doing a teardown. We had Anand from AnandTech.com on to talk because they had done a teardown earlier in the week. And it's really funny because Microsoft's gone out of their way to make it an obvious, really impossible to get into without breaking clips, which means they'll know if you've been inside modding things or changing things around hardware-wise. Quieter. Not hugely quieter,
noticeably quieter. Actually. We made a couple of videos for that teardown article. One of them was a kind of a audio test where we just used standard mic. We had the mics that we use for recording shows and stuff, and made a little bit of a noise change. I know a lot of people complained about the Xbox 360 noise, so I figured if we have that queued up, we'd go ahead and play that and. Not only people who are watching on video, people who are listening on audio will be able to get an idea.
Noise from a previous generation Xbox and a new Xbox 360 Slim. Now we're going to record the idle sounds of the currently existing, the previous generation Xbox 360 console. Now we do have to say this system is a little bit older. I mean, it's not a brand new system, so there might be some noise changes here. But here we are at idle at the dashboard, holding the microphone about 2 feet away from the system.
That's idle, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, now we're going to use that microphone to do a 360 around the console itself, holding it about just a couple of inches away from the console.
Ow.
And here I am standing about 2 feet away from the Xbox 360 that is sitting playing Assassin's Creed 2 at a kind of a pause point here. And here we go, turning the mic directly at the 360.
That's a lot of air you are hearing from the old system.
Okay, now I'm going to take the microphone and I'm going to move it in a circle around the 360 a couple times, just a few inches away from the body of it at any point, so you can see how loud it is kind of up close, and you can be able to hear the disc moving and that kind of stuff as well.
Watch your ears for this one.
Okay, now we are recording the new Xbox 360 Slim under idle mode, just at the dashboard, and we'll hold the microphone about 2 feet away from the system so you can see noise from it. And there you probably can notice that the idle fan with the larger fan spins much slower. It is a little bit quieter. Here is a 360 rotation around the system a few times while it is at idle at the dashboard. All right, we are recording audio from the new Xbox 360 Slim, as we're still calling it. And here we are standing about 2 feet away from the Xbox while we are in Assassin's Creed 2 in gameplay mode. And the system's been...
So this is the loudest point for
the last 5 minutes or so. So here we are about 2 feet away from it with the microphone pointed directly at the Xbox.
Did you have to pull your headphones off for that, Patrick?
No.
Okay, and now we are going to take the microphone and move it around the Xbox 360 as it sits here. It circles around it a few times so you can see the noise in general, just a couple of inches away from the system itself.
Still loud.
But at least the high notes aren't there quite so.
Yeah, exactly.
Intensely.
That must be the other one. Okay, so yeah, so I don't know where that last noise came from, but it was it's noticeably quieter at idle, like significantly quieter at idle, right. Which I think is important for a lot of people. If you use it, if you use your machine for Netflix, if you use your machine for other non-gaming purposes, streaming, if you don't not doing any 3D games.
There's nothing worse than like a quiet scene in a movie, or especially if you're watching something that's very dialogue dominated and hearing.
It's, you know, it's a very very important moment where the secrets of the movie are revealed and you've got the jet spinning up on your optical drive. So that's definitely improvement. Now, obviously we had the bigger fan on the new system, but the technical reason that the Xbox 360S was able to do this is because they have moved from 90 nanometer and 65 nanometer chips down to 45 nanometer chips. Now also in a combined CPU-GPU package on the motherboard itself. So power consumption was way down. I think playing Assassin's Creed 2, we went from like 130 watts to just under 100 watts. Not, you know, 30 watts isn't a huge deal in terms of maybe a power consumption for a PC, but in terms of a console, that's noticeable and generates a lot less heat. Therefore, you have to use less substantial cooling, therefore less noise when you watch your movie and play your games. So I think it's overall a pretty big change for Microsoft. And I think, I'm curious what you think in terms of the console lifespan. The fact that they spent this much time kind of redesigning things from a technical level indicates to me that we have at least a couple of full years left with this generation of Xbox 360, that they're not going to suddenly turn around in December or next June and have another machine out for sale.
I think if they were going to come out with another machine for sale, they would have done probably a more serious CPU power upgrade, a more serious GPU power upgrade.
Right.
Maybe put a, you know, the ability to throw a, you know, Blu-ray disc in there or something. Because a lot of people are like, why didn't they really increase the power so games would look better? And it's like, well, you have a huge installed base of Xboxes, and then you have this brand new Xbox with a little tiny installed base. Nobody's going to develop games for the power on the new tiny or the new super powered Xbox 360 with the tiny installed base, right? It just doesn't work. It's never worked for any console manufacturer. So finally, all the console manufacturers are like, okay, we won't do that anymore. But yeah, I can't imagine. You know, I think Microsoft may regret not have thought about stepping it up a little bit, because I think they're probably waiting for 1080p television penetration to be more serious. I think they're also still just, you know, either the PS3 and the Xbox 360 are kind of back and forth. I think, you know, if the Wii threatens to go 3D, then I think they may think about starting another platform. But at this point, so much money, Sony and Microsoft have sunk so much money in the development of these consoles. I think they want to play them out for as long as illogically possible before they try to make another hardware investment. You know, you've got 720p video coming out of both of them, or some reasonable facsimile thereof. Yep. And for most console games, that's more than enough. So we'll see.
Now, we also did I don't know why I didn't think to do this while we were taking it apart, but we did kind of like a time-lapse video of the reconstruction process of the Xbox 60, the 360S, from its, you know, heatsink removed, bare motherboard, back to putting it inside its chassis and putting all the clips in the right or wrong spot the first time and all this other kind of stuff. And it's kind of interesting to see, not only because it's, you know, your typical Benny Hill type of humor level to it there. You can see the intricacies of spreading thermal paste on it as we try to not kill our brand new 360. I don't think it... Actually, I think we had never actually turned it on. No, I think we did turn it on one time before we turned it, took it apart, but only take it to the dashboard. So that's always, it's kind of interesting to see if you're, you know, if you want to take yours apart, this will help you know what to do in reverse. Right? We thought about actually doing it in reverse. Or playing the video back in reverse, but
the thermals do seem to be a lot better in terms of the design of the console and the airflow. like maybe they were paying more attention to the concept this time around.
Well, you know, it looks to me like what they probably could have done if they wanted to was make this machine smaller. The PCB, the actual motherboard itself, looks a lot more bare, a lot more spacious. There's a lot more just kind of empty area on it, and I think they did that just so they could. You know, kind of, you know, try to avoid the RROD issues of the past and kind of maybe over engineer for cooling and spacing and that kind of stuff, as opposed to just getting it down to as small as possible to kind of say that they shrunk things just to shrink the size of the console. So hopefully what this means is people who are, you know, replacing old dead Xboxes or are upgrading Xboxes or buying Xboxes for the first time, finally, that we'll have less of those, you know, potential hardware problems going
forward.
That
would be nice. Especially for people who are replacing their Red Ring of Death for the last time, or maybe if I know three people who are buying one of these simply because they're hoping to not have the same, like, they love their Xbox 360, they're in a serious Red Dead Redemption kind of place, and they want to keep playing the games in the Xbox 360, but they don't ever want to deal with having to ship their Xbox 360 back to Microsoft again. So
Yep. That's a good step to take, I think. And the only you copy your hard drive data over, and you should be able to just turn on the new 360 and go from there. As far as I can tell, I don't know if maybe Nan had any more thoughts on this. There doesn't seem to be any kind of performance like clock speed improvements or that kind of thing. We did notice improved load times on games somewhere.
I would probably say 55. I'd lay the load time improve directly at the foot of the hard drive at this point, because
maybe optical drive a little bit too.
Possibly, because you know one of the guys I used to work with a lot at Dell, and this is about 1,000 years ago. He's like, we're specking out drives, and he's like, you know, I need 8x, you know, CD-ROM drives. And the guy at the factory is like, well, we'll give you 16x. He's like, I don't want 16x, I want 8x. He goes, 16x for the same price as 8x, because we're not making 8x anymore. So yeah, I'm sure the drives. I think drives speeding up probably has a lot to do with that performance improvement. Like I was saying before, there's not much of a point in increasing the CPU or GPU performance, because you have this huge installed base of consoles. The majority of the Xbox 360 platform is all people who are not going to have that performance improvement. So the developers are not going to develop a game that they can sell to this much of the Xbox 360 audience, but they could sell it to this much of the Xbox 360 audience.
Right, kind of. Maybe even analogous to the upgrades in iPhone processor speeds and how it has divided the market, the application developers as well as game developers are able to address and sell to and that kind of stuff. So,
not to mention the actual operating system itself.
not to mention that as well. So we do want to talk about OnLive. I think we'll have some interesting discussions and things. I don't know. Have you had a chance to play with it yet, Patrick?
No.
At all? Okay. So we spent a little bit of time with it here. Before we get to that, I do want to take a quick break and thank today's podcast sponsor. That would be Carbonite Pro. Now, business PCs crash all the time. We usually talk about consumer, you know, your own desktop. But if you're in a small business, even if you're in a larger, medium-sized business, you know, you need to worry about backup. You need to make sure your business can run on. And Carbonite Pro is the product for that. Business PCs crash all the time because of hard drive failures and viruses, especially if some of your employees are, as they say here, less selective about what they download on their PCs. But you can be sure to keep your business up and running even if your computers aren't, with Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro backs up all the PCs in your business automatically whenever they're connected to the internet. It's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave the computer. It's easy to use, whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged tech head that listens to our show. It's automatic. Carbonite backs up your files automatically whenever it can. It's affordable, with pricing starting at just $10 a month, and you pay only for the amount of backup you need. So you don't need to spend thousands of dollars a month for this if you don't need to take advantage of that much kind of spacing and capability. And it's one account with one monthly bill. So you get a centralized dashboard to give you or your administrator a backup status summary of all the computers in your business. You can tell if somebody maybe has disabled or hasn't had their computer on the internet in a while and they need to do a checkup to back up all their files. If there's ever a data loss problem, each employee can access their own backup files themselves. They don't have to go through the administrator if you don't want them to. The admin can be notified and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And because they're backed up offsite, each person can access their own files from any computer or even their iPhone or BlackBerry with Carbonite's free applications. All this means you can focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. They have a good offer for everybody here. You can try Carbonite Pro for free for 30 days with prices starting as low as $10 per month. And there's no special product code or anything like that for this. All you have to do to try it out is go to CarbonitePro.com. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Now on to OnLive. Speaking of offsite technologies, we've got offsite backup. Let's talk about offsite gaming. Now, I think we kind of gave the general overview of what OnLive was last week. So imagine, if you will, not eating.
Gaming on the cloud.
Yes, yes. Let's use as many cliches as possible. It's cloud computing.
Sorry. These are buzzwords.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. So the idea is simple. Server farms in a remote location render your game. And rather than doing all the processing on your own PC, they just spit out the final rendered images of said game over the internet to your PC. So you see it as a streaming video feed, essentially. If you're watching us at live.twit.tv, it's essentially just like this is what OnLive would be, only instead of seeing Patrick and I, you'd be seeing a video game. And then, you know, you're controlling it with your mouse and keyboard and that kind of stuff. And then it sends that input back to the servers. Servers say, okay, here's what he wanted to do. Render it, compress it, send it back to the computer, and you get this nice little endless loop. Now, in theory, it should work great, right? and it does, actually. I know, Patrick, we said you hadn't had a chance to play with it yet. I don't
think I'll ever get my beta invitation. So I was skeptical. I think latency is going to be a nightmare for a lot of people. You, however, have actually had your hands on it.
Right. So I had my hands on it several months ago when it was in its beta phase. And long story short, I didn't like the results. It was really kind of a poor experience with some games, like the first person shooter twitchy games like Unreal Tournament 3, Burnout Paradise, which was kind of a racing game. Kind of an arcade-style racing game, not like a simulator racing game. So the controls were a little bit more fluid in that type of title, and it was actually a better experience. Like I could deal with any of the input lag that I might have had. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the interesting things was that I felt that if you used an Xbox 360 controller, like a USB Xbox controller, rather than using a mouse and keyboard with these games, it actually kind of hid the latency a little bit more, because as a PC gamer, when I go to play console games, I feel like there's a little bit of that latency or kind of lag or delay anyway, mm-hmm. because, you know, when you flick, expect it to react. But when you've got a thumbstick, you can only move it so far. So they kind of limit how fast you can turn and that type of right. thing. But we got to try it now. It's not in a beta anymore. It's available to the public. They're kind of releasing it a little bit at a time. And my account got activated, and we was playing Unreal Tournament 3, Dirt 2, Batman, those types of things. And, you know, it has some really strong points. One of the things that I really, really like about it is you don't have to install anything. You have to install the OnLive client on your computer. It's maybe like a 10 meg or 20 meg install, something like that.
Nothing these days.
It's really, really small. It's less than downloading like Acrobat Reader, which says something about Adobe, not necessarily about OnLive, but
right.
It's a small download, and it's a thin client type of thing. You can run it on supposedly most PCs. You can run it on Intel graphics. Doesn't, like we're saying, it's kind of hardware agnostic to a certain degree. One thing that's interesting about it is the loading times on it, because you don't have to install the game. You just click on it, and you know, there's a little bit of a delay. I think we have a little video here queued up, but it will show the time from going into the service to when you actually start playing a game. This is all in real time. So I'll kind of do a voiceover here. So I click on the marketplace, I click on Batman, and then I click on play demo. And you know, you get it, you're here, we're looking at a little bit of a loading screen where it says starting game, so it's got a little video that plays in the meantime. And it takes, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds type of thing. And I, in the background, the server is loading the game up, creating a new instance for you. And there you go. Now we're at the standard load screens that you would see if you started the game on your PC. So technically, the game is already up and running. You're already in the game at this point. So you'll see here, we'll go through these kind of loading menus. Unfortunately, they haven't gotten rid of these in the games yet. But we're playing Batman Arkham Asylum. We didn't have to, you know, install anything. We're not taking up any extra space.
And you were playing here, this live from a PC in the labs, as it were.
I was sitting here in Florence, Kentucky, and I have no idea where their servers are. I think they're in Virginia, Washington, D.C. area, the ones that I connect to. I think they have them at three different locations. And, you know, that's great. That's what the casual gamer needs, right? So PC gaming is typically known to be difficult because you have to have a disc and you have to install a game and you have to wait and then you have to go into settings and all that kind of stuff. Whereas an Xbox game, we were just looking at the new 360, you pop in a disc and it starts. This is much, much closer to that. It's almost, it's better than that because you don't have to switch any discs around.
And it's all 2D, so 3D graphics power on your system is meaningless.
Right, right. Now, what's interesting about that is there were reports, I think, on Tech News Today with Tom Merritt, another show on the Twit Network. They were talking about somebody who had a Pentium 4 single-core processor, like a 3.2 or 3.4 gigahertz part, a fairly fast processor, but it was old. Right. But it was only a single core. And on live, the client said that you didn't have enough hardware to play this thing, to use the OnLive client, that they didn't have enough processing performance for it. And when you think about it, I'm not really sure. Maybe they're just using too blunt of differentiators at this point in the client to decide if whether or not you're allowed to play it. Because my notebook here, this is like a Core 2 notebook, it will allow it to run. But an Atom-based netbook, even if it's a dual-core netbook, will not run. So it's kind of hit or miss still. But think about that video that we showed you of that loading screen. Mm-hmm. Using a bandwidth monitor was using 750 kilobytes per second of bandwidth. So five megabits or something like that? 4.5, 5 megabits. That's a lot of bandwidth. And it needs to have it continuously. It needs to have it, without interruption.
Right.
And I don't know how much work it takes to decode that video, which is a processor job. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, if it's 8.264 video, then it takes a lot. MPEG-2, considerably less. I'd be really curious, have you tried running OnLive and watching the CPU usage history and the task manager or anything like that?
No, I think we did do that. I don't think I have anything that on video or photos yet. But no, if we didn't do that, I don't know why we didn't, because that would obviously answer the question of how much processor. Actually, I had to have had Task Manager open to figure out how much bandwidth we were using. I don't know why I didn't switch tabs. But no, that's a good idea.
We're focused.
We jump to different machines, right? Task-oriented, unfortunately.
Also, I just remember the first time I really understood exactly how powerful my Core i7 was when I was encoding like 4 CDs simultaneously, you know, at about 15x, and it was taking literally, I think, part of one core.
Yes. Those are benefits. So, and it might be that maybe I just don't remember how slow a single core Pentium 4 processor was. Right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the case. Now I'm still working on writing an article for PC Perspective using these videos that we're showing here. But I have a few of them of different games, Unreal Tournament 3, Dirt 2, and Batman. And we do some interesting side-by-side comparisons. Now, I don't know how well, I don't think this video is going to translate very well for people watching on the live stream or watching on the video version, because, I mean, you need to see it kind of in its full resolution 720p video. that will be available in the article when we see it, or if you just go to the YouTube videos. So we start out here in Unreal Tournament, and it's really hard to tell in the stream. But one of the things you'll notice, this right here on the left is on live service, and on the right is on a native PC. And there's definitely a blurriness. There's definitely a lack of sharpness to the image that I think is being, well, I know is being introduced by video compression, right? So we're sending 720p images at up to 60 frames per second, and we're only using 5 megabits per second of bandwidth. So obviously, you know,
there's going to be compression in there. It's like watching, watching HD movies over satellite. You're getting, you know, most of what you're supposed to get, but the detail gets lost. That made me wonder, are you able to play these video games with people who are not on live? Are there group modes where you might find yourself competing with people on PCs rather than on the on live network? Or is it all, you know,
not sure.
Person versus? Okay.
I'm not sure. The game where that would be most interesting to see would be on Unreal Tournament 3. Now, it would depend on what OnLive's goal is. If they want to say, hey, we're ubiquitous, we're just like, this is real PC gaming, but anywhere you go, then they would let that happen for you to play against people who are on native PCs. But if they're like, you know what, there is a little bit of kind of a latency, a lag issue, that we want people to be on the same kind of level playing field that maybe we only have on live to on live. And that would especially the game like Unreal Tournament, or if they do, you know, Call of Duty games or Modern Wake Warfare. 7. Yeah. I mean, that would be a definite drawback if that's the route they plan to go. And in terms of it's better in terms of latency. Now I have to say that playing Unreal Tournament 3, was much better than it was several months ago, but it still wasn't perfect. Like one of the benefit of that client was that you could easily alt tab out of it. So I had the PC native game running and the online version running at the same time on the same computer, because
very good for performance.
No. But I mean, we were well under what the system could handle, because we were only running it on the native PC version at 720p as well. We ran it at the same resolution as the version coming in over OnLive. And a 6-core 12-thread processor at 3.4 gigahertz didn't really have any problems with it. But it was, when you do things like in a first-person shooter, we want to turn around quickly. You can tell the difference. You can tell the difference there. There's no doubt. But in a game like Batman, where it's a third person kind of button mashing type game, you know, click, 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 click for punch, 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 punch. Right. You couldn't really tell. It was a good overall playing experience. Now, there were a couple of hiccups, and there's one other video I want to show today. I don't want this entire episode to be dominated by videos, but there was a video corruption issue, and this was one particularly bad instance of it that we happen to be recording on. And you know, kind of like when you're watching streaming video, you'll get like a hiccup. You just a pause for a second, and then everything will come back, right? And you get those with OnLive in the 10 hours or so that we've been playing of it. But there was one instance where it paused for a little bit longer. We got kind of corruption squares as you're used to seeing, and I was in a race in Dirt 2. And it caused me to crash into the wall. And I'm thinking, that's not good for a gamer. At least that was my excuse for it. So if we have that video back, we'll see that real quick. So again, all this is happening in real time. By fraps. So you can see me here. I'm racing. I'm not doing very well. I believe I'm using a keyboard for this for whatever reason. And you'll see the video freeze. And it's not your stream or YouTube. It will be the gaming service itself, right about here. Okay, and then, oh, you see all that? That was all what I saw. crashed into the wall.
That's pretty ugly, dude. Did you? Yeah. I guess you...
That only happened to me one time. In the amount of hours we've been playing, that only happened one time. And we happened to be recording during that, unfortunately, for OnLive. And we have had maybe a half dozen to a dozen of the you know, third of a second, half of a second hiccups, but we don't get that visual corruption on screen and that kind of thing. But I think it would only take one instance like that of somebody who's really into a racing game, or, you know, they're racing their friends and crash into a wall and lose. To kind of be like, maybe this isn't the best possible outlet.
Well, it's also in beta, which means it has a relatively limited number of players. I mean, I'm really, you know, on one hand, this could be a great, inexpensive way to get a lot of games into your kids' hands. On the other hand, you know, your kid might be insanely frustrated because they're not getting the performance out of the video games, or they're just getting their ass kicked because you have a slow ISP or something like that.
Right.
And given how ISPs are hammering, it'd be really interesting to calculate how much of your monthly bandwidth allotment playing this for like 2 hours a day will take up.
Well, I can tell you we could do that math easily because no matter what was happening on screen, we really maxed out at about 750 kilobytes per second. When there was motion going on at a static screen, we got down to like 650 because of the compression algorithm. So you think 750 kilobytes per second for a 3 hour gaming session is going to be quite a bit of bandwidth there. So, you know, we're talking.
It's a gigabyte.
Is it?
750 kilobits per second times 3 hours is 989 megabytes. So that's a gig an hour.
Yeah. So there you go.
That's a gig every 3 hours. So you'd have to do a lot of gaming to blow a 250 gigabyte cap. But if you're downloading movies or buying your music, well, mostly movies. If you're buying movies online or downloading movies and playing 3 hours a day, let's see. Well, you know, you can do the math at home.
I've actually got that at, is that 2.7 gigs an hour? I don't know. Maybe my math is doing wrong on this too. But yeah, so 750 times 60 times 60 would give you how many kilobytes per hour you're actually using. And I'm coming up with like, I don't know, big numbers. So, I mean, it's interesting when we get into the world of, you know, like Comcast limiting to 250 gigs. And, you know, now the issue is not, are you downloading too many games via Steam on your PC, but are you streaming too much gaming through all your PCs and TVs at your house? So, you know, but I do want to end and say on live discussion that I actually think the service has potential. I don't think it's for the hardcore gamer, but I think it will introduce people to new games. They have some interesting pricing schemes. You know, we talked a little bit about some of the potential downfalls to licensed games that you don't really own and don't have a disc for and that kind of stuff. But for instance, on Batman, you could do a 5-day game pass for $6.99, which gives you essentially you're renting it for 5 days. And it's kind of cool to be able to rent PC games. You've never really been able to do that. Since people figured out that you could just copy floppy disks, right? So, you know, if you feel like, I can finally finish Batman in a few days and, you know, I'm homesick, you know, with mono or whatever it is, right? You can pay $6.99 and have that game and have that experience and be done with it. And you don't have to spend $30 or whatever it is for the full title. So that's always kind of, I mean, that it's interesting to see what they'll be able to do with it. And like you said, in terms of getting younger people interested that, and don't forget they have other games other than these kind of more hardcore titles, World of Goo, you know, Trine, a lot of kind of point and click action adventure games, you know, those types of things, latency wouldn't be an issue. Your only issue is going to be video compression, whether or not you can deal with that and go on from there. So I still think it's a very interesting service, has a lot of questions. And I think maybe targeting the hardcore audience is not what OnLive should be doing, but instead, you know, going towards the more mainstream guys. So
be fun to watch.
Yep.
Especially since they plan on building a little box that you'll be able to plug into your HDTV to play video games. That'll be a fun one to watch.
Yeah. So you got to figure that box has got to have some kind of video decoding, and that's all it's really got to have. It's got to have a Ethernet port. Because they aren't. That's one thing. It's odd. They're not supporting Wi-Fi. They will detect if your computer is using a Wi-Fi internet connection, which seems kind of arbitrary to me. That my 802.11g. Like I guess I would say they should give you a warning rather than just not let you play it at all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised they They should ask you before you sign up for it. But having seen so many performance issues on 802.11g and 802.11n based on positioning in the house or people walking by or a microwave oven going on, I can see with a company that is so dependent on the vagaries of the internet for its success, they probably want to completely eliminate the issues once the internet is inside your house. And the only way to do that is to stipulate a hardwired Ethernet connection.
Yeah. And they do a bandwidth test to make sure you have enough bandwidth to support it. One of the guys that works for me here got accepted into it. He kind of, he maybe fibbed a little bit in the bandwidth test when he signed up, maybe just a little. But I think he has like 2 meg DSL service. And it was like, no, I don't think so. Because like I said, I mean, mine was pulling 5 megabits steady the whole time. And that's a lot, I'm used to saying, well, we've got 20 and 30 meg service. You probably have 50 meg service down where you live.
You'd never know it based on the performance and the testing.
But they advertise it and they sell it to you as 50. But
they cash the checks every month. So 750 kilobits per second?
Kilobytes.
Kilobytes per second.
Yeah. Okay. So 750 kilobytes per second. So about a 5 megabit connection or something like that. So, I mean, it was substantial, right? I mean, I'm used to getting a 1 megabit stream from Leo's video service, so I knew we would be able to handle that. Or wait, no, that's okay. I was wrong. 1 megabit there. Right. So we're doing it's like doing 5 of the Twit live streams from Bitgravity at the same time. If your connection can handle that, then you can get the best OnLive can offer.
Well,
all right, let's talk about the iPhone 4. I had a quick note here just because we got some love to Microsoft. They opened, unfortunately for them, they opened their 4th ever Microsoft store in apparently one of the biggest malls in San Diego this morning, the same day as the iPhone 4 launch. And apparently the Apple store and the Microsoft store are like in the same mall. So there were competing lines and this kind of stuff. And it was really interesting. One of my friends lives down in San Diego area now, and she was happening to be walking by and took video of the Microsoft thing. We don't really need to show that, but it's a countdown from 10 to 0, and they drop the banner and the store's open and people are allowed in. They said there's a bigger group at the Microsoft store launch than there was at the iPhone 4.
That's because they're counting everybody standing there trying to figure out why the countdown is going on in the middle of the big open-air mall area.
It turns out they actually had celebrities on hand doing meet and greets. So like Paul Rodriguez, professional skater, and some pop singer that I didn't recognize the name of were like doing autographs and stuff like that. So Microsoft kind of paid for their promotion there, whereas people were spending $200 and $300 a pop at the iPhone one.
Well, Apple was spending a fair amount of money because they had to have the staff on site. It was weird at the Stonestown one where I was waiting. They actually bought a sack lunch for everybody who was online at noon. And they had coffee and bagels in the morning for everybody waiting online. A buddy of mine, David Randolph, used to work on System with. David actually, he couldn't get a reservation, so he started standing in line at 4 a.m. last night.
Sounds familiar.
And they said they had about a 1,000+ pre-orders at the store, and it's kind of in one of the outskirting sections of San Francisco. The line at San Francisco, the folks at App Judgment, they had one of them go to Stonestown where I was, and one of them went to the downtown store. Mm-hmm. And the person at the downtown store, it was a crazy. The line wrapped all the way around the city block and kept going.
So like looped itself.
Literally.
I've been on that block. That's a long line.
It was a long, ugly line. So it's certainly a financially successful day for Apple, I would think.
Yeah, our video editor did the same thing. He went in here in Cincinnati area, went and got in line about 5:30 a.m. And I believe it was about 6 or 6:30 p.m. when he finally was going home.
Ouch. I feel better because I got there. I had to ended up having to take my son to daycare this morning, and so I got online a little after 9 and had my iPhone 2:30, quarter to 3, which just really wasn't the plan I had, especially after the iPad, where I sort of like stumbled into a, oh, look, there's an Apple store in Santa Barbara, California, and 15 minutes later, I had an iPad.
I did that in Chicago. I was down Michigan Avenue, and I was like, I wonder if they got any, you guys still have some available? Yeah, okay, bought it, out the door in 10 minutes.
This was not that. Yeah, so it looks like a phenomenal rollout. And I was actually able to register my phone, activate my phone really quickly, which a lot of people had concerns with after AT&T's abysmal performance during the registration process. So
but not everything apparently went well for Apple with the iPhone 4 launch. What is this issue about left hands coming
out? Okay. Well, there's two things. So they were mailing these out. Either somebody oopsed and a package of these went out on FedEx or however they were shipping them early. And there's some phones that are basically having a yellow tinge or some issues with the screen. Fortunately, I haven't found any of those yet, and I've been loading white backgrounds and looking at it. But one of the things they made a big deal out of is you can just see, so there's a stainless steel band that forms the exterior. And you can see right there by the headphone jack, there's a line, and then again on this side, and again over here. And what those are essentially are three separate sections of steel to create the antennas for the radios inside of here. So I would assume Wi-Fi, GPS, and of course 3G. Mm-hmm. So what some people, not everyone, have been running into, but what some people have been running into is if you cross your hand holds here, they've had a massive dip in performance. So basically, you can see where there's that. I don't know if I can get it up on this camera without. There we go. It's not the best macro camera. But basically, if I ground those two antennas together, which is pretty natural if you hold a phone in your left hand like you would if you were operating the volume button. They're
holding
having
it to your head for a phone call.
Yes. Look at that. Your hand naturally grounds those two areas, those two separate antennas. And apparently have been having dropped calls and or vastly decreased network performance. At this point, it looks like a very small subset of iPhone 4 users.
Do you really think that? I was surprised by how many people and how many different videos I saw on Engadget and YouTube and these other places where it's the phenomena of holding it. And actually, Leo demoed this on a phone this morning, I guess, when they were doing their live coverage, where you held it and you could watch the bars like every 10 seconds go down from 5 to 1. And then some people, you know, they were have videos of people doing drop calls. I hope it's not really widespread.
Yeah,
I fear
not as much as I do.
Well, yeah, that's right. I didn't stand in line to buy the phone. But I mean, how could if it's not 12 people, let's say it's a couple of thousand people. What are the conspiracy theories about how did that get past Apple?
Well,
there was the theory of the bumper cases, and they knew about it, and that's why they designed this bumper case, because, you know, it's the first time they've ever designed a first-party bumper case. And, well, that's, when you have the rubber on around it, you're not grounding anything.
I think Apple's learned that they can make a lot of money off accessories if they have them in the store on the ship date. And I think they want to pick up the scratch there. Also, it's easy to do side sales. I have my new phone. I want to protect it. I'll spend an extra $30 for a cheesy-ass piece of plastic, right? Obviously, I've broken enough screens at this point where I'm a little desperate to protect things. But I'm not sure if everybody was running into it, because, like, you know, I can't really get it to show up on the screen, right? But
happening to you, though.
There's no impact on Wi-Fi, and so when everybody hears these strange clicking noise in a second, you'll know it's the Wi-Fi. And I need to point out, I work in a Faraday cage. This building that I live in, work in. There's a Freudian slip.
Feels like
my wife. was a cannery. The floors in this place are tiled with 12-inch by 12-inch by quarter-inch steel plates that were designed to mount huge industrial canning machines, and it's reinforced concrete. So literally, it is a Faraday cage. But so this is pretty normal. I don't know if you can – I don't think I can get in there. See where it says you can't
Searching,
read it.
Searching, yeah.
there. You can just sort of start to read it there. That's pretty normal inside my building. And that's pretty much happening whether my thumb is on there or not. I was playing around with it outside some. At this point, I'm not seeing it. I can go run out and hang my head out a window and check again real quick if you want.
No, I believe you.
But the you know, Gizmodo and Gadget, other places, some people are running into this. It seems to be a serious minority. Oh, there we go. We got two bars.
Woo!
And I'm going to ground the section.
Now hold it like you would actually hold a phone.
Next to my head? Yeah, it's having no impact. So... You know, and two bars is pretty awful reception to begin with. Oh, wait, it just went down to one bar.
There's, if you go to engadget.com right now, there's a, it's got to be a fake email correspondence between somebody and Steve Jobs. There, the email says, I love my new iPhone 4, but when I put my hand on the steel bands, I lose all reception. It appears to be a common issue. Any plans to fix this? And the response from Steve is, just avoid holding it in that way.
Yeah, or AT&T would love that too, right? Because they make the money off the sale, but they don't actually use their network. that would sort of be the perfect phone. We'll take your monthly payment, just don't use the network. That's you know, it's we'll see. You know, I'll be curious. You know, my where I live in the Outer Sunset, which is the sticks. For San Francisco, I can't use a 3G or a 3GS in my front yard or in my house. So I'll be very curious to see how this does out there, to see whether or not there's any better reception. So I'm going to use this for, oh, look, and now it's, speaking of conspiracy theories, I just put the little cover on and it's gone up to five bars.
Well, it's confirmed, ladies and gentlemen. Buy your accessories, otherwise the phone doesn't work.
Yeah, this is extremely non-scientific circumstantial evidence. You know, so what is interesting though is one of the things people are saying is that this phone should do a better job of determining which, if you have multiple cell towers, which is an issue here in San Francisco, and they overlap. Traditionally, in iOS, I guess this is more of a feature of iOS 4. I want to say, I can't remember if it's iOS 4 or the new chip, but the idea that they now have a better ability to discriminate when, you know, just because a signal is stronger than another signal doesn't mean it's as consistent or the signal is of as good a quality. So it will differentiate between the strongest and, you know, because everybody's had that, like, I have five bars. Why can't I make a phone call? Well, that's because you're having difficulty logging into the cool guy tower with five bars. In theory, now the iPhone will be able to go, hey, let's use that tower with three bars that we can actually connect to, which would be a pretty massive improvement. So it's an interesting product launch, because AT&T said they had 10 times the response for the iPhone 4 than they did for the iPhone 3G. That was part of their excuse for getting slammed last week. So right. I'm going to be really curious. I've just barely started to play around with this, but the going from the 3G to my wife's, playing around with my wife's 3GS was a fantastic performance improvement. Going from the 3G to this is a ridiculous performance improvement. So it'll be fun. It'll be fun to basically get the navigation apps out on this later and play some videos and see what's going on with that. Plus, actually downloading the iMovie application because I want to play around with 720p video capture. And then we're going to record Twitch from my iPhone in the field. Oh, wait, I can't use Skype over anything but a Wi-Fi network. So
what you do is we get somebody at the Twit Cottage to have FaceTime and then hold it up to a camera, right, on their iPhone 4. And then it's perfect. That'll work. I mean, I can't see how that wouldn't work perfectly.
Yeah.
I like the cool proposed perks. Fix. The kind of internet hack fix is to take electrical tape and run it along that steel band.
I'm currently in a Twitter argument with Dylan Tweedy, who's one of the editors over at Wired Online, who's a fantastic reporter. But he's like, duct tape fixes it. And I'm like, dude, they're using electrical tape in that video. So, but yeah, basically cover the steel bits, and you'll save yourself the trouble if you are running into that. I'd say if you are running into that, you should immediately head to the nearest Apple store or AT&T store and do an exchange on that one. Hopefully they'll accept
that.
Hopefully
they have any left.
Wow, we should move on to the next story before we start hurling things against their screen.
okay, this is also another kind of PC thing, but, you know, You are with iPhone 4. I am without.
You are with Evo.
I am with Evo. Right.
Your blood enemy sworn to kill.
Fight. Have you ever used the swipe interface?
Not like even once. Scheme?
But not I hear even people once. I hadn't over. Either. I had never either. I saw some people talking about it on Twitter today. And it turns out, I think today they released a public beta for most Android phones for the swipe interface. And what's interesting about it is, well, I think they had commercials for it for a different cell phone where somebody set like a texting world speed record or something using it, right? And I thought it was proprietary to that phone, but it's actually a separate interface. And what it is, let me see, I don't know how well this is going to show up on camera for a demonstration purposes. It's going to be a little bit upside down-ish, if nothing else. So here, glares are awesome. You can see Gmail is open. And when I click there, it brings up a keyboard interface, kind of a blurry one, but a keyboard interface. And rather than just, you know, you can just type stuff if you want, like normal, or you can use this wonderful swipe interface where you just kind of drag your finger across the letters as they should appear or as they should be. So let me see if I can, let's see.
It's basically you're tracing the pattern of a word across the elements of a keyboard rather than typing individual keys.
Right. And cool. It's smart enough to, you know, like if you type the word quick, which is really slow because I'm doing it upside down. It actually came out right, but I traced my finger across Q-W-E-R-T-Y-U-I down to C and then back up to K, and it was smart enough to know that pattern. And again, this is not working well in terms of it wanting to focus on stuff behind it. But I've been pleasantly surprised by how well it has worked. And, you know, couple of things, you know, it didn't know what Twitch was. It didn't know what the word podcast was. But all you have to do is input that word one time manually and hit the space bar, and it adds that into its database. And then you can just trace it, you know, like you normally would with any other word on here. And there's little tricks to it. So like if you have, maybe you're typing the word battle, it has two T's next to each other. You do a little like, it says, the actual tutorial says, do a little squiggly on the T. And it'll do a two-letter combination there. So, you know, you just go B-A-T, squiggly, L-E, and it just works. And as soon as you lift your thumb or your finger, whatever digit you're using, off of the phone, then it knows you're at the end of a word. It will do whatever math it does to figure out what word you were trying to spell. And most of the time, it's actually gotten it right. And it kind of brings up, if there's multiple words, it'll bring up a little pop-up box that you can tap with your thumb. Or you just keep going on to the next word, and it will pick the top one on that list. And I wrote a couple of emails out with it, and it works. And it is definitely faster than typing with one finger. And it's, mm-hmm. I feel more faster than doing the two thumb method as well. The problem is with a phone this size, you know, the 4.3 inch screen, it's when you in landscape mode, I can't really get the swipe functionality right. down because my thumb has to go so far.
That's a hard
far.
One to move your thumb all the way across that giant area, but exactly. I can definitely see the keyboard this way working a lot better.
You'd have to do two hands that way, you know, move your but it's faster. It's actually faster for actually typing out words. It's not faster for email addresses, telephone numbers, things like that. You still have to kind of use the push thing, but I like it that it's the keyboard can work both ways. You know, if you want to just type something out, you can. Or if you want to do the swipe thing, you can. And it's a free download. I don't remember the URL, but it's S-W-Y-P-E. Look that up, swipe for Android. And
is
you
that
going to
work on all Android operating, or all versions of the Android operating system, or just the latest hardware?
I don't think so, because you have to register, and then it will send you an email. The email has a link in it that you then click through their website to download it, and it uses it knows what device you're coming from, so it downloads the correct version for it. So I'm sure that it's not all of them, but mm-hmm. I mean, this Evo is a stock 2.1 operating system, so I'd imagine anything running 2.1 would at least have a really good chance of it. So, you know, right. Motorola's, HTC's, all that kind of stuff. And it's, hey, here's another advantage to an open phone. I just, you know, I didn't have to install, I didn't have to root anything. I just downloaded it and tried it. And I had that option, Patrick. which is just, you know, something to go with.
I feel like I've been mocked for my iPhone.
No. Everybody else I know has an iPhone. And I tell you what, if I could walk across the street to Walmart and pick one up for $200, I probably would, just to play with it and see with it and be the gadgety guy that I am. I would, but standing in line for 14 hours, I wasn't real apt to do. So
no, I was in line for a lot less than that, and it certainly was not something I enjoyed. But I also had my previous phone was a broken, shattered mess, and it was time to replace it, since I could know the home button finally died, and at that point an iPhone becomes really hard to use.
yeah, I can see that. Let's see, we want to jump into our Twitter questions, or do we have anything else? Okay. All right, we only have a few here, so we will jump through these. I'll read out the first one here. SOD Dark Angel, or SOD Dark Angel, asks, SSDs for SQL databases. I like those questions, short, quick, to the point, no overabundance use of words or letters. The answer I would spout out immediately is yes, because... if ever there was a need for very fast random access to what could potentially be very random pieces of information in a database, rarely in a database, I don't want to say rarely, but most of the times when you have a database, you have small bits of information spread about many, many tables in different locations. You're not reading, you know, a whole bunch of data at a time, which is where the benefits of SSDs over traditional hard drives are a little bit more muted. Random access, dude, SSDs are the way to go. The only concern I would have, and I would ask Alan about this next time I talk to him, is do you worry about kind of the wear leveling issues and the degradation of performance in any way with an SSD? Because not only are you reading at random locations all the time, but you're writing in random locations all the time, in theory.
It's kind of interesting, the wear leveling on SSDs. Reading essentially has no impact, right? Because you basically set a state on the gate, and then until you change that, you know, until you flip the bit again, it essentially it has, you know, there's no where, you know, where it happens at the individual bit level, right? So reads aren't particularly an issue. Writes are where you're going to actually kind of wear a drive out. There's a lot of numbers floating. We actually talked about pretty extensively on Techzilla about this a couple weeks ago. Essentially what Intel did is they tried to figure out, they went to the major manufacturers and said, how many gigabytes of data per day do your users typically write? And they all kind of went like five, you know, we want to be able to write 5 gigabytes of data for X number of years. And I want to say they more than doubled that. And then the way the wear leveling works is by the time you wear the drive out, you should be on your like 5th or 12th generation of drive past that, even if it lasts a good long time. Because obviously Intel wants there to be absolutely no, you know, they don't want certain, you know, basically like in the perfect world, Google would look at these drives and go, we want them for everything, right? Google, of course, being the people who pioneered using cheap consumer grade drives and billions of servers and having billions and billions of servers to back up the rest of your billions and billions of servers, so that server hardware becomes a commodity item, the way they're scaling it. In terms of the SSDs, the way wear leveling works is basically the fastest way to wear a bit out is to write to that bit over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, but you don't really write to the same bit. Okay, my scratch file could technically write to the same section of the drive. So the drive is designed to sort of write to different places as it moves itself around. And the idea is that between the wear leveling and the fact that you do a lot more reading than writing in most cases, you should get years and years and years and years and years. You should have a significantly longer lifespan on the drive than you are likely to actually have it installed in anything that's used. So that's kind of the more technical explanation of that is probably on Techzilla, because I don't have my crib sheet in front of me. Because when you start looking at the math for this stuff, it's really interesting to see how they decided to calculate how they decided to calculate, because they needed a metric that was that people would understand rather than discussing like individual writes across bits across drives. But the short answer is it's Intel builds their drives to last twice as long as the OEMs wanted them to. And the OEMs wanted them to last, you know, probably 5 years. So, you know, I would worry a little bit more with some of the cheaper drives.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean to get all long-winded there.
No, go ahead. Why don't you take our next question here?
JG Stew at Ryan Shroud. Spec-wise, the Belkin Play seems like a great router, but it's had some bad reviews and problems. I need a good middle router. And I assume by middle, that means that cheap. Didn't you listen to last week's show?
Yeah.
We
still have this question, right? And it's the reason I put this in here is because we had several of those questions last week and this week, and I know we're still kind of, it's a really, really tough question to answer. The only reason I put this particular one in here is because I actually bought a Belkin Play or the Play Max or the Play Mega. I don't know. There's like the N one on it. I don't know how they do their modeling is model numbers. Right. You're using words now are pretty weird, but I've never not been able to set up a router before.
That's a bad sign.
And this one was it. It's like it gave you so few options because it was this the title Belkin Play is supposed to indicate that it's easy and you know you just plug it in and just
plug
works
and
was
like
I wanted to set up a security and you know I needed to pass RDC remote desktop client through a different port or something like that and I couldn't do it and it was like literally like 3 hours during my day and I went you know what screw this and I packed it back up I took it back to Best Buy. And that's when I bought the WNDR 3700 Netgear model that is still right. So.
Yeah, Netgear can do a lot of really good reports. I got a tweet actually, or an email, I'm not sure which, from a Best Buy employee that told me that the ratio of Linksys routers to Netgear routers was off. That Netgear has most of the sort of networking aisle, and Linksys has kind of a corner of it. I understand the ideas, you know, that Linksys and Belkin are doing, where they're going to dumb down these routers and make them super idiot proof. But the problem with a foolproof system is only a fool uses it, or maybe only a fool can use it successfully, which is not taking anything away from the whole target audience for these routers. But a lot of this stuff, the more you automate it, the less useful it becomes, I think. So yeah, I'd stick with the Netgear or the higher end Linksys routers and avoid anything that says, you know, super easy, no configuration, up in seconds, and never ever use the install disk. If you know anything about setting up a router, don't use use our easy setup CD and carry it from system to system, like run. Like the first thing I do, like open a router, I don't round file it because in case I need to return the router, but it definitely goes to the bottom of the box immediately.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
agreed. Real quick note from the chat room: they pointed out the swipe add-on now supports Android 1.5 and higher, and all supports all screen sizes. So that's why the kind of mini launch today of the beta. So give that a shot. Question from Stu E. Ross says: my iPhone 3GS reports about 30% signal strength right next to my router, and 75% outside in the street. But 100% nowhere. Any idea why?
Man, I'm assuming you're talking about Wi-Fi signal strength and not 3GS signal strength.
Yeah, he mentions his router. So.
Yeah. Okay. Wi-Fi is weird, and antenna propagation is even weirder, right? So. Yeah. One of the big misnomers you see an antenna, right? I'm going to hook this aftermarket antenna up to my router or up to my Wi-Fi card, and it's 9 dB. And that means it's going to like suck in 9 times the amount of signals. And it's like, okay, that's not the way decibels work. And more importantly, what's really interesting about the decibel measurements is they're not changing the amount of electromagnetic energy that's coming out of the antenna. They're shaping the amount of electromagnetic energy that comes out of an antenna. Because in theory, right, there's a point at the end of your antenna, and in a sort of an ideal world, the radiation comes out of it equally in 360 directions and shoots off in space equally in all directions. So when you go from, like, you know, the sort of the 0 point antenna to like a 3 dB antenna, what it does is turns the signal into kind of a donut, and the signal is kind of weakest at the antenna, and then goes in this big loop. So if you can imagine this big toroidal donut kind of hole-shaped thing with your router in the middle of it, as you go up from, say, you know, a 3 dB might be like this, a 9 dB looks more like this, and a 14 dB is this really flat kind of a signal that comes out the side of it, unless it's a directional 14 dB, in which case it's going to be sort of this light beam that goes, you know, in the direction you point the paddle or the cone or the parabola or whatever it is. So what happens, right? So this is my router in the middle of my toroidal donut. So the signal is actually going to be stronger away from that router and weaker the closer you get to your router, right? Because people generally don't put their device right next to the router. Usually the router is in the closet, it's in the basement, it's on the other side of the house. And this is one of the reasons why moving your router around your house can be one of the most effective ways to actually improve your wireless connection, because you may, you know, it may be a steel wall, it may be a bundle of electrical cables, it may be some pipe, it may be just that you've actually figured out the optimal location to ruin propagation of Wi-Fi signal at your house. So you try moving it to different locations. So obviously, you know, you need to, if you want your phone to work where the router currently is, you need to sort of measure the distance of that point on the street and then move your router like that many feet over to get the signal to land right on top of your device. Or you can
stand farther away.
Try rotating the router like 90 degrees, you know, and turning it around. It's amazing what playing around with your router can do in terms of just making the signal propagate. You know, if you have a 3-story house, don't put a 9 dB antenna, because the 9 dB antenna means your neighbors are going to be able to get the signal, but somebody on maybe the 3rd or 4th floor of your house is going to pick it up. Conversely, if you're sort of into like spying for Wi-Fi, if you're in an urban area, you need an antenna that propagates way off the ground and doesn't just work in this big flat loop. So that was a tip I got from some Wi-Fi sniffers at DEF CON a few years ago. But yeah, it's just antenna propagation. You need to play around. You can basically, you can map your antenna signal strength. That's a really fun thing to do, but I don't have the props with me to properly discuss that.
All right. All right. How about our last question here, last Twitter question of the week.
WebDaddy at Ryan Shroud, I am building an i7 rig for web development on Linux and VMware. What type of video card should I get? Also, I was thinking about RAID cards too. RAID is a stupid idea in a consumer system. RAID 1 is a less stupid idea.
I would almost always recommend RAID 1
for
hard drives that you have important data on.
Yeah, RAID 1 essentially is mirrored. Hard drive 1 and hard drive 2 have the exact same writes occurring to them. A lot of people are like, I'm going to stripe my drives to get RAID performance, buy an SSD.
We call that death wish RAID.
Yeah. The highest rate of return RAID, the rate of pain. The other reason I bring that up is because a lot of consumer-grade RAID controllers, if you do it in hardware, suck. They tend to die. Mm. And then if you can't actually replace that original RAID controller with pretty much the same model that came out around the same time, you often can't pull the data back off your hard drive. So if you do decide to go for the RAID for speed, do me a favor and back up regularly. Use that Carbonite code. but if you do decide to like tempt the fates and use RAID, just make sure you back up. You know, RAID 1 obviously is a form of backup. RAID 5 again, but RAID 5 is a little more complicated than most people are going to do inside their system. Get an SSD drive, a small SSD drive to host your operating system and your applications. If you have a software application that does a lot of writing to a scratch disk, you can get a second SSD drive to use as a scratch disk. And then I'd probably, you know, a small SSD, like I think it's $130 now to get a 40 megabyte SSD, Intel SSD. That's like the best SSD you can get right now. I think it's $130. It's a stupid performance boost, especially on launching applications and reads and writes. And then get a cheap, a 1 terabyte drive is what, $60 now? You get one in a box of Cracker Jacks.
two terabyte drives are
coming down to like $130. Your video card, I think, and Ryan, you can address this much better than I can, but your video card really comes down to, do you want to do 3D gaming? If you don't want to do 3D gaming, get the cheapest delete expertive graphics card you can find that'll work with your motherboard, because if you're not doing 3D gaming, all of the performance advantages of 3D gaming are kind of useless, dot, dot, dot. And you can be like, what about NVIDIA? What about CUDA? What about ATI's acceleration? Find out if any of your applications can actually take advantage of that acceleration. Because I was recently talking to somebody, they're like, well, I'm building a Hackintosh, and I'm going to get a really fast graphics card because it'll accelerate Final Cut Pro. No, while there's some really cool stuff going on in Premiere's video editing, if you have the right graphics card accelerated, Final Cut Pro doesn't actually do any of that cool guy, you know, acceleration on the graphics card. Some applications do, some don't. You really need to look at what you have, especially in the open source community, and figure out if any of that will take advantage of the 3D graphics, dot, dot, dot. Now, if you've got a 30-inch monitor and you're willing to run Windows to run games, then it's time to get a big, fat graphics card.
He says it's an i7 rig for web development on Linux and VMware. So, yeah, if you're not doing gaming, don't worry about it. Linux and gaming are a little bit testy anyway. If you're doing VMware to Windows for gaming, then, you can still – you have issues there with drivers and that kind of thing. As far as maybe which company better supports Linux, I am still told NVIDIA probably has slightly better – Linux driver support, although ATI has been doing a lot of work on it. The point is if you're doing web development, you don't really need to have a super high-end graphics card. So anything, you can look on the ATI side at the 5700 series or the 5600 series. Those cards are going to be $100 or under, have features that will be able to take advantage of stream computing if you want to be able to down the road, or if Linux implements some of that stuff down the road. You can look at the what's the GeForce lines now, the GeForce GTS 250 is probably going to be around $100 now. You can go less than that as well. Just depends on how safe you want to play it for your video card. So
yeah, if I'm not gaming on a machine, I'd just go for a cheap graphics card. Whatever the cheapest thing will run Windows 7 happily. And Lucid Links.
Close.
The new version of Ubuntu is awesome. So I've been pretty excited about that.
Cool. So that's going to wrap up the show for this week. Next week, we will be back normal time. What is today? Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern time, 6 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv. Of course, you can go to twit.tv/Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, to download the latest episodes, get the video, subscribe in all your favorite audio/video players. Next week, we'll be talking about NVIDIA Surround, NVIDIA 3D Vision Surround. So if the idea of having three 3D displays for gaming sounds appealing, check in next week. I'm staring at them right here. So far, pretty good, playing around with it. So we'll have articles and discussions about that for next week as well. And hopefully we'll have actually my final, we'll spend some more time with OnLive. We'll actually open up the device manager and see how much CPU horsepower it takes by Patrick's suggestion. And for some reason, we left out. And that's it. So thanks everybody for watching. Thank you for listening. Everybody in the chat room watching us live, we really appreciate it. And with that, we will see you next week.